Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for attending this morning. Can you hear me at the back? Is that okay? Thank you. Right, good. Lots of nodding. Thank you, Ronnie. Good morning. Welcome to Go Ahead's full-year results for 27th of June 2015 for year-ending. I'm going to go through the highlights as per normal. I'll hand over to Keith to go through the detail of the numbers. I'll come back and put a bit more flesh on some of that, and then we'll have a question-and-answer session after that. So overall profits are up 11.1%. It won't help if I show you on the screen. Overall profits up 11.1%, slightly ahead of our expectations as a result of stronger performance in rail. Despite some difficult headwinds that we've got on bus, which we will explain later, we've got record bus profits up 6.6%. And improvements in the rail profits have been good, but albeit they're actually at historically low levels and low margins. We're a sound business. We're continuing to have really strong free cash flow and a robust balance sheet. And our confidence in the business means that we are proposing a full-year dividend up 6.5% to 0.90. And that's in line with our progressive policy on dividend. We're making continued progress in the bus division with sector-leading customer satisfaction in regional bus operations. However, due to headwinds, which we will explain, we expect to deliver our 100 million pound bus operating profit target in 2016-17, which is a year later than we originally anticipated. The group's net increase to the DfT in the year was 191.9 million, with a total net contribution of 255.9 million. So we've had a challenging start in GTR, which has been well documented. It is the U.K.'s largest train franchise. And we're working closely with industry partners to improve performance and manage very complex contractual changes. We've got a number of opportunities in the pipeline. We submitted bids for the Northern and the TransPennine Express franchises, and we've been shortlisted for the London Overground contract. We continue also to explore selective opportunities in overseas markets. So those are our highlights. And now I'll ask Keith to go through the numbers. Thank you.
So, as David's already highlighted, overall results were slightly ahead of expectations, albeit bus slightly lower and rail higher. Our overall group revenue was at 19%. 14.6% of this was obviously the taking on of GTR. Operating profit up 11.1%. Record bus profits, albeit slightly lower due to Quicks and regional revenue, particularly in Q4. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And rail profitability was helped by some contract management benefits towards the end of the year related to the end of the Southern franchise, which aren't expected to reoccur. So looking at regional bus revenue, revenue was up 2.6%. We did flag, actually, at the half-year that we would expect lower growth in the second half because we would be lapping some contract gains. But particularly in the last quarter, the last 2 months, trading particularly not great. So you can see 1.2% at the second half of the year, -2.2% passenger journey growth in the second half of the year. And that's on the back of continued economic weakness in the Northeast, roadworks in Oxford and Brighton. And David will talk a bit more about this later. And there's no distinct difference between commercial and concessionary revenue or passenger journey growth, pretty consistent across the year. And the start to the current year is broadly in line with the second half performance. So breaking the profit numbers down to a little bit more detail, operating profit for regional bus was up by 4.8 million. The key movements being a small benefit on claims, albeit some reversal in the second half due to a couple of large incidents the second half of the year. The majority of the movement is broadly underlying organic growth with like-for-like revenue outstripping cost inflation, albeit perhaps not as much as we might have hoped. Fuel cost movements, we'll talk about that later, but we had an expected benefit on fuel hedging. And we did flag earlier in the year about bid costs for Singapore, 1.3 million in the year. And in total, 1.5 million we've probably committed in total for the two bids that we've so far committed to. And as far as margin's concerned, we've seen a consistent margin performance over the year, a step up on last year, but perhaps, obviously, H2 a little bit disappointing given the flat revenue growth in the second half. Moving on to London, revenue was up 1.8% in total, but then you have this BSOG reallocation, which sort of flatters that a little bit. So when you strip the 1.2% out, the underlying revenue growth rate was 0.6%, and that was largely driven by mileage being down 0.9%, as we expected. But as you can see, with stronger mileage performance in the second half of the year, and we are expecting, because of known contract gains, our mileage growth to be about 2-3% higher next year. So we are seeing an increase in market share. But I think the big story for us is around Quicks and the reduction in the second half of the year. Overall, 4.5 million down, largely in the second half. And that's something I think that we weren't, it was even slightly worse than we were anticipating, I think, at the pre-close statement. Once we settled the fourth quarter Quicks performance, and I think we were expecting that to flow into next year. So looking at the profit bridge in total, obviously a small increase. Big focus this year in London, in particular, on accident prevention and managing claims, including some historic claims. We've had the benefit, again, of fuel costs. The fall in Quicks obviously is the big significant movement. We also had, in the second half of the year, around 1 million of impact through the strikes that we had earlier in the year, which one wouldn't expect to reoccur next year. But margins overall, broadly consistent again year on year, but again, probably lower in the second half of the year, reflecting the lower Quicks performance. Probably one of the most important slides is onto fuel. So FY15 that we've just had, obviously we were at 48.5 pence per litre. That was consistent with the £2.5 million benefit that you saw come through the profit bridges. We'd already hedged this time last year for FY16 at 45.8 pence a litre. And that locks in approximately £3.5 million of benefit into FY16, the year we're currently in. But since the year end, we took the decision to lock in at really historically low rates for FY17 at 37 pence and FY18 at 35 pence. And FY17 at 37, that's an £11 million upside approximately on similar volumes compared to FY16. And then that would increase to £13.5 million compared to FY16 and FY18. So as you can see, there is a tailwind coming regarding fuel. Moving on to rail, I guess Southern has now been integrated into GTR. We did have some contract management benefits that came in towards the end of that franchise as we start to settle some of our contractual disputes. So that helped the current year, but wouldn't be expecting to reoccur. Southeastern, we saw a strong trading performance since new contract terms. When you look at the H1, H2 split, particularly on passenger journeys, it looks a bit unusual. And that's because both halves were impacted by travel card allocation distortions. I think, though, if you look at the passenger revenue at 8.5% and the passenger journeys at 3.1%, that's reflective of the underlying performance of Southeastern and was greater than around the 7% revenue growth we assumed in the DAC, which has contributed to a strong Southeastern performance. London Midland continues to operate on its original terms. We're now in the process of a 7-month extension to March 16 in advance of hopefully a direct award negotiation, and performance did improve in London Midland in the second half. GTR continues to trade well from a revenue perspective, so strong revenue growth, but obviously operational issues, network changes that we've experienced since the beginning of the franchise have meant that so far in the year we made a small loss. However, weakness in GTR has been offset by stronger performance in Southeastern. We expect that to continue, and therefore overall expectations for rail remain unchanged. So looking at the operating bridge, this largely describes the significant contractual payment changes, but operating profit up 6 million, again, partially due to some of these contract benefits. Total passenger revenue up by 36.9%, including 484 million for GTR. 120 million of that is retained by the DfT. We collect the revenue and we get back a franchise payment, and the difference is 129 million. And as David has said, overall payments, 255 million at 191. Bid costs of the year, as expected, around 9 million, including 2 million for Germany, and we had some mobilisation costs capitalised, as expected. So overall, looking at the summary income statement, if I just pick out a couple of points not covered by the other slide, within amortisation, we had a 4.9 million goodwill impairment relating to a couple of businesses in East Anglia. Our effective tax rate was a bit higher than expected, 24.7, as opposed to 14.9% last year. Last year, we had some benefits on deferred tax from the reduction in statutory rates. This year, the 24.7% is higher. I'll come on to that in a while. But that does explain why EPS growth year on year is not as great. That has distorted EPS growth in both years. So EPS up 2.2 pence. And as David said, the dividend increased by 5.5 pence. Dividend policy and the IAS 19 calculation that supports that policy are included in the appendices. Briefly look at finance costs. So excluding non-cash items, which are IAS 19 unwinding of discount provisions, our finance costs, cash finance costs went down by 0.9, and that reflects higher cash holdings, which we'll talk about in a little while. We renegotiated our facility, so we had lower margins, offset partially by some termination costs when we ended our previous bank facility early. We have extended, though, that facility now for another year to 2020. Tax, as I said, was at a higher rate. The effective rate of 24.7% was due to higher non-deductible items, in particular the goodwill impairment, which is not deductible for tax, and also German rail bid costs, which are not deductible in the UK, but would be deductible if we won a franchise in the future or recoverable in the future. Statutory rate expected next year at 20% and ultimately declining to 18% by 2018 in line with government recommendations. And we would normally expect 1% to 2% above the statutory rate, as we always have some deductibles. We did have an exceptional item in the year. We did flag this, 8.8 million, which was within to do with the integration, which was within the expected range of £7 to £10 million. Moving on to cash, I think lots of noise around working capital, but I think the overriding thing to get from this is any positive working capital movement is equally and reflected in restricted cash, and therefore any reversal of that working capital will be equally impacted within restricted cash. It doesn't impact on our adjusted net debt to EBITDA numbers. But notwithstanding that, we did see a big working capital increase, 70 million due to the inflow of GTR, perhaps slightly higher than originally anticipated. 107 million was due to us receiving payment for GTR franchise payments in advance of us taking on the Southern franchise. So we got a benefit that will end up reversing between now and the end of March next year. And then the balance is due to season tickets and timing of contractual payments. So we'd expect that's about 50 million. So we'd expect that 50 million and the 107 to reverse during the course of next year. So all of things being equal, a working capital outflow of around 150 million next year. And again, it's worth pointing out that pensions, we add back the impact of IAS 19 non-cash. So actually cash margins are higher than actually we report because of that non-cash pension charge. So looking at balance sheets, obviously 292.9 million net cash was more than we were anticipating. But actually our adjusted net debt of 1.32 times was in line with kind of where we expected to be. And that is now below our target range of 1.5 to 2.5 times. And restricted cash is now up to £537 million. And then finally, pensions for next. So our deficit was largely unchanged year on year. Our net operating costs reduced from 6.7 to 2.7 following the closure of the DB scheme, although that will be offset by an increase in DC costs elsewhere, including auto-enrolment. We have an actuarial valuation coming up. It's March 15, and we expect that to be due next year. And actuarial valuation assumptions do differ to the accounting assumptions, so we'll have to see how that plays out over the next few months. And then finally, capital expenditure. Bus CapEx was a little bit lower than anticipated, due mainly to timing, and we'd expect that to flow through into FY16. And FY16 bus capital spend of £70 million will include some timing impacts, but also now more London contract renewals than we were probably anticipating because of things like Paul Quick's performance. Less of our contracts are getting automatic two-year extensions. Therefore, more will come up for tender, and the assumption, therefore, is we will win them and have to replace buses. So £70 million bus spend in FY16 and £80 million in FY17, but then reducing back again to £40 million FY18. The only thing I would say that might vary on that is if we take on new Route Master buses, then we wouldn't have to buy those buses. They would be funded by TfL. So that might be a reason why these numbers slightly differ. But that's it for me. The full set of accounts is included on the website. We produced the full set today, so please peruse them at your leisure. And I will now hand you back over to David.
Thank you, Keith. So I'll take you first through regional bus, where our operating profit is up 11.5%, with improving margins up to 13%. It's part of a record overall bus profits, and I would say, but it's considerable progress from when we started out on our journey in 2012 for the £100 million profit targets. We then had margins of 10% and bus profits, including London, of £70 million. So we've moved a long way. The customer remains our priority in terms of without them, there is no business. And I'm pleased to say we have amongst the major group the highest customer satisfaction rate score in the UK with the bus sector score of 90%. It shows that profit growth has actually been achieved sustainably and we're actually doing the right things in terms of our customers. We keep mentioning it, but there's been some strong headwinds this year. Large-scale, long-term roadworks in Oxford have resulted in delays and congestion which have automatically deterred travel. We reported this at the half year and that there is a two-year period of infrastructure works taking place around the city and moving their way around. Pleasingly, and with very proactive marketing, we are getting passengers to come back to us. So when their corridor is finished, they are actually returning. And that's what we hope eventually. That's what's going to be repeated as the roadworks do eventually finish. And echo similar experience in Brighton, where the roadworks have now been concluded. In addition, and we've reported before, there's ongoing economic weaknesses in the North East and their economy, and that impacts passenger volumes. So, for example, unemployment rates in the North East remain stubbornly 3% above the UK average at over 8%, and that reduces economic activity. So we know people are travelling by bus, but what actually changes, we believe, is their discretionary travel, the extra trip to the shopping centre, those sorts of activities actually reducing the amount of travel in the North East. We continue to ensure that our bus app stays ahead of the competition, and our new bus app now provides easier payment mechanisms with PayPal and Ping It and improve real-time information so that people actually know they can plan their journey better, they know when the bus is coming in real time. And we're fitting Wi-Fi onto our buses because we know that actually attracts people and retains people and is all part of the package that we try to give. We've introduced multi-operator smart ticketing in the North East and with more to come. And we've also introduced the same in Brighton, giving passengers more choice and more flexibility. We initiated and led the scheme in Brighton, for instance, and actually in the North East we're working closely with Stagecoach to actually introduce the scheme there on a multi-operator basis. We continue to invest in our fleet, £180 million over the last 5 years, and that's in order to maintain an average fleet profile of about 7 years. No discussion about bus would not be complete without some reference to the political outlook. And so we have a bus bill that will be moving through Parliament and most probably entering the statute books beginning of next year. And that is being paralleled with the devolution bill, both of which are actually pretty unclear to us, and actually how they're linked together is actually quite unclear to us at the moment. We are working with the DfT where we can on all of this, but as you can imagine, this is new ground for all people. Partnership working is how we conduct our business and always have and always will. We continue to engage with the DfT, with MPs, with other stakeholders, with the PTEs to help inform that debate about the bus bill. And what we believe is we're part of the solution. We're an integral part of the UK transport industry, and we will find solutions that solve the problems of the PTEs and the local authorities. And as I've said, we've invested over £180 million in our regional bus services. And this investment, and this is what we say to our stakeholders, can only come from the profits that we make. We're a professional business, we provide high quality services, and that's evidenced by our customer satisfaction rates, and we respond to the needs of our customers. And we have a devolved management structure, so we believe that actually positions us well in terms of greater local accountability in political structures. So we will be relying on our experienced local managing directors to convince local stakeholders about the value we bring to their bus services in their areas. But this is not just about defending the present, it's about finding future solutions and looking for opportunities. And we remain adaptable and responsive to those changing world and changing competitions. And I just remind us that we only operate 7% of the regional bus market, so there are opportunities do exist for us. And again, no mention would be complete without going to the Tyne and Wear, where for a number of years now they've been looking to introduce a quality incentive contract scheme. And the QCS board have now held their inquiry during the course of July, and we expect them to give their opinion in late October. We continue to believe that a voluntary partnership would provide a better outcome for both passengers and taxpayers. The risks and costs and lack of custom benefits that the quality contract scheme deliver, we think, have been fully exposed during the inquiry. We would say that, wouldn't we? But they really have been. Turning to London Bus, we do remain the largest bus operator, running 24% of the services, and we retain our market share with broadly consistent margins now. The congestion experience in London in the second half of the financial year was, perhaps from my personal experience, the worst since before congestion charging was introduced in 2003. It led to huge difficulties in running a reliable service, and works associated with things like the cycle superhighways, regeneration works, public realm works in places like Elephant and Castle and Lewisham disproportionately affected our services. And you only had to be travelling around central London from March onwards to recognise some of the effects that it had. And these high levels of roadworks congestion do impact our ability to earn bonuses through the quality incentive contracts. So the contracts we bid for in London are gross cost contracts. We have to control our costs, that's what we understand. But our ability to earn more money is through providing a reliable, regular service, and that's where we get bonuses. And at the moment, we've had difficulty in actually achieving that, which is what Keith said, towards the £4.5 million. On the plus side, TfL get it. They're committed to improving what we describe as excess waiting time. They have their own targets to actually meet and beat in terms of that, and we're working with them to mitigate congestion. And we had a similar experience in Oxford in terms of what London have experienced is a decline in passenger numbers against their original budget by 6.5% on fare-paying passengers and about 7.5% for non-fare-paying passengers. And we have those same experience in Oxford. If you don't provide a regular, reliable service, people will find other ways of travelling. And that same thing has happened in London. So TfL are putting more resources into the routes on a transitory basis to get through some of this. They've introduced a new scheme for outer London, so we can find a way of actually gaining bonuses through the sun of Quicks at the moment. And we're looking at ways in which we can capitalise upon that to improve reliability and gain other bonus payments. We do remain a high-quality, cost-efficient operator, and we've got a very experienced management team. We've got high contract retention rates. Routes are lost, routes are won, but overall we continue to maintain our market share. Overall, London remains a unique place to be operating buses as a vibrant economy and a growing population. Population growth, I've said this before, the underground drives the economy, the buses drive the population. So population growth increases demand for buses as the city heads for 9 million people. And TfL are still looking to have a growing network. They've got 500 buses planned within their budget over the next few years. And we will be ready for that. So we are, at this moment in time, at a very advanced stage in negotiating two additional freehold properties, which will provide us with additional bus capacity. Turning to rail, better than expected profitability, but at historically low margins. And it's been a good result, despite operational challenges that we've experienced. So it's coming up for a year now. We've been running the UK's largest train franchise. And we're now the busiest rail operator in the UK. We account for about 35% of all UK passenger journeys. And whilst our profits have grown by 6 billion, there's been a net increase in contributions to the DfT of 191.9 million and an overall net contribution of 255.9, 10 times our profit rate. Our core focus is on delivering our commitments for our existing franchises, but we do believe the rail market offers significant opportunities over the coming years, in addition to those franchises which we are already bidding for. So just breaking it down into the individual TOCs, Southeastern is now under a new direct award contract and it's delivering a very good trading performance. It's a win-win between us and the DfT. As we do better, the DfT do better because we're in a profit share mechanism. And we have a close working relationship with Network Rail, looking for improvements in operational performance. Southeastern have actually, a combination of that, actually have been less affected by operationally by London Bridge and have actually introduced a new timetable and getting progressively better in terms of their performance. Southern, they have actually been significantly affected by London Bridge. The evening peak was expected to cater for 24 trains an hour into London Bridge and we can only accommodate 20. That has a ripple effect or a domino effect across the whole of our network and across the whole of our services. And we've since January been now undertaking about the fourth iteration of timetable changes to try to balance capacity and performances, which is what we're trying to do all the time, and minimise the inconvenience to our passengers. Doing all of that requires cost. Doing all of these changes requires cost in terms of drivers and cost in terms of rolling stocks that we hadn't originally anticipated. However, we are performing in line in Southern within our financial expectations, continue to roll out the key. And following the year end, we successfully integrated the Southern network into GTR, a major organisational change. Turning to London Midland, performance has continued to improve throughout the year and they are making a modest contribution to profits. And it's taught us lessons in terms of how to actually recover a franchise and the fact also that it takes a long time to do so. And we're working with the DfT over regarding a planned extension to October 2017 under a directly awarded contract process. And we hope to conclude that in the next couple of months. Turning to GTR, we commenced trading September 2014. Creation of a new business, new leadership team, a new culture, a new programme of works for customer improvements. And we've been working very hard at that. And there's been dramatic changes from our perspective over the last year. However, we've had disruption through infrastructure issues. We've got the well-known London Bridge story, plus we've experienced flooding early this year at the Clerkenwell Tunnel, and all of those together have created some significant operational challenges that we hadn't expected to be tackling, I have to say. We've introduced an improvement plan with Network Rail to address these issues, and the increased investment is essential to improve services and will deliver significant benefits in the long term. You've heard me say it before, but this is all part of a government £6.5 billion Thames Link improvement programme, and which will lead to the rebuild of London Bridge Station, which will give more trains, allow more trains to serve it, provide more frequent services and with more capacity. And one of our new trains, the 700 class, will hopefully be hitting the Thames Link corridor in early next year. So everything's on track in terms of delivering our part of this bargain. Southern and Gatwick Express, as I said, were successfully integrated into GTR, and that was only 6 weeks ago. It's no mean feat. That was a huge operational challenge. We actually expected that to be our biggest challenge in the first year. Major upheaval, reorganisation of thousands of staff, changing structures, changing organisations. We do expect our margins to be impacted in the near term, but expectations over the life of the franchise remain unchanged. We are, however, heavily reliant on third parties to achieve this. So we're operating a timetable that is recognised by DfT wasn't the same timetable that which we bid for, and we are operating on infrastructure that is recognised by Network Rail was not the infrastructure we expected to be bidding on. And all of those changes trigger a complex set of contract variations with DfT and Network Rail. They're interlinked between them. They're interlinked in terms of what the original contract was. They take a long time to work through, and they will continue to be carrying on over a number of years. But the first two ones will be just recognising the capacity at London Bridge isn't what we planned for, and that's cost us more in terms of driver resource and rolling stock resource. Part of our remedy and our partnership of all this is to get more staff into the system And so we actually, at this moment in time, have the largest number of staff in a trainer school across the UK and delivering the largest numbers out onto the network. So we've got 300 staff, about 100 have been passed out, and we've got 200 in the school. And it takes a year, this is one of the reasons why I said about London Midland, it takes a year to actually get a driver through the training school. So all of this has a lag effect in terms of improving performance. Looking for what other opportunities there are, we consider growth prospects both within and outside of our traditional markets. We look for value-added opportunities in line with our measured approach to risk. We've submitted bids for Northern, for TransPennine Express, and we expect those contracts to be awarded in November of this year. We've been shortlisted for TfL's London Overground contract, and we will be considering a number of the other opportunities that come up in the UK rail franchising environment over the next 2 years. So, for instance, over the next year, there are 6 ITTs that will be issued, and we will be taking our views about which ones we bid for. We're bidding for contracts in the German regional rail market, and we're submitting a second bid for the Singaporean bus market as well. So all in all, there's actually a strong pipeline of potential opportunity coming out over the next year to grow our business further. Finally, coming to summary and outlook, FY15 has begun with similar trends flowing through from the second half of 2014-15. In bus, we anticipate steady progress towards £100 million of operating profit. As I've said, that we expect that to be achieved in the following 2016-17. The headwinds experienced in the past year should reverse over time. Roadworks will end. Transport for London will introduce different ways of dealing with that. They will end eventually. Passengers will return. Quicks will improve. And along this, we will have reduced fuel costs. So this gives us continued confidence in the prospects for the bus division going forward. In rail, we expect stronger performance in South Eastern, and that will continue to offset underperformance in GTR, which will carry on for the next couple of years. Our focus remains on delivering operational improvements, delivering benefits to passengers, and managing contractual challenges, which we are going to have to deal with. Continuing discussions with the DfT on the extension of London Midland from 2016 to October 2017, and we hope to agree favourable terms on that shortly. And then, as I've already said, we have a pipeline of opportunities to grow the business, starting with Northern, TransPennine Express, London Overground. And then we have opportunities abroad in terms of both the Singapore bus market and the German rail market. And finally, we remain in a strong financial position. Keith has taken us through that. Good cash generation, robust balance sheet, supports a progressive dividend policy, and now allows us to pursue value-adding opportunities. Thank you very much. Now the bit you've been looking forward to, the questions. Who would like to? Damon, you're right in my eye line.
Oh, yeah, it's okay. I think.
Oh, is it? Oh, big one. You're in my eye line, but.
Edward Stanford from Lazarus.
Edward, hi.
Can I ask a general question about politics and network rail? First of all, there is a comprehensive spending review underway. Do you have any inkling as to how that might affect the bus industry, if at all? And secondly, clearly, network rail now on the government's balance sheet is coming in for also some pressure. Do you see that affecting your business, or how do you see that going forward?
These are certainly important issues. Where it affects us directly at the moment is, as I've said, we're going through some complex contractual changes, and some of them will require money somewhere along the way. That's part of the process. And when we talk to DfT officials, they quite rightly say, actually, at this moment in time, our credit line's been stopped. We're going through a spending review. We have to emerge from the other end, the other side of that spending review. To see what is available. So that has delayed some of that process, that's definitely. In terms of what might come out the other end, I'm afraid we're all in a bit of a guessing game. There's no smoke coming out yet that gives us any kind of clues. I think you'll find that in terms of rail, there's a lot of promises have been made, so politicians will want to keep to those promises. At the same time, there is good passenger growth on the railway, so that should give them confidence that they get an income coming in. I mean, that's what happens on GTR in terms of the passenger growth. They get that income.
So they'll be balancing those two things off. In terms of on the bus side, we're not hearing stories that BSTOG is under threat, but I couldn't, that's all I can say. I haven't heard those stories. But also, again, there's been a large play in terms of how buses and their role in economic growth across the regions of the UK. So they've got to balance those two issues in terms of their spending review. I think it would be foolish of me to predict at this moment in time. Thank you.
It's coming behind you. Damien Burr, RBC. Can I ask a couple of questions, please? First of all, just about general group capacity to change and do things. Given you've got CapEx going up, and I assume that London bus number includes the freehold depot acquisitions, you've got working capital outflow next year, you've got effectively two rail franchises you're turning or having to turn around, you're bidding for franchises, and then you've got to recover from the roadworks issues in UK bus. How much capacity is there to focus on the sort of the big costs you're putting into Singapore and Germany, and how much risk have you assessed in terms of distraction to the core business? It feels like there's an awful lot of ambitious things to do.
I'll do it overall, and then Keith can.
I'll
do the people and do some money. It's a good question. We are very selective about what we bid for. We do it thoughtfully. We're not just a scattergun approach in terms of all the contracts. And in terms of, so for instance, we have a bid team in Germany, a very small bid team. The cost of bidding for rail franchise in Germany is quite low, certainly low in comparison with bidding in the UK. And we have a bid team that we build up in the UK as well. So they run separately. We manage that within known costs. We manage that as best as we possibly can, but we don't overstretch ourselves. We've got an in-house bid team. Actually, that's a cheaper way of doing it. So we think we do that very sensibly and very intelligently. On the bus side, so for instance, we've done a second bid for Singapore bus contracts, and we did it on the back of all the learning we did the first time round. So it hasn't been doubled the money. It's a much reduced cost for bidding for that. In terms of capacity of people, we've got the right people in that we can actually draw from our businesses without actually affecting what's happening in those businesses. So we feel fairly comfortable. I think there are good questions in terms of how much money you put into this. And again, we balance that all the time, and I'll pass the money over to...
I think when we talked about this, about entering Germany and Singapore markets, they're still relatively low-risk entries into those markets. We're not committing a huge amount of money, so £2 million in Germany, £1.5 million in Singapore. Relative to the growth that we could get back from that, it's not as if we're making large-scale acquisitions. And I would also use the US experience that we had, where we bid sensibly, won a contract, and then exited without losing any money. Our mantra is to be sensible and conservative with the bids that we operate. Just going back to your point about bus capex, these things go in cycles. We've had a couple of years where we've had lower London capex because we had good Quicks performance and we had lots of contract extensions. Over time, these things even themselves out. We'll have 2 years of higher capital growth. Those numbers don't include the properties because as of yet, we haven't committed to them, but as I said before, it might even be, might be lower than that anyway, because if we take on more new route masters, we don't pay for those. So I think for now, I think that's still a good number to use. And as far as the working capital is concerned, we've got £537 million of cash that we can't use. So when that working capital goes out, that cash goes back down. So in effect, from our perspective, it doesn't impact our capability or free cash flow at all.
I think I'd also just add the comment, which is that, and I used to say this when I was running the buses in London for Go Ahead, this is part of the game. If you've got to spend your capex, if you're in this market, you've got to spend capex. It's part of the nature of it. If you don't want to spend capex, don't come into London and play this game. And similarly, bidding for contracts is what we do as a business. That's what we do. We've got to balance it, but in the end, that's how we win work. We bid for contracts, we put a lot of effort into it. We know quite clearly that if you want to win, you've got to bid professionally. And we put the right amount of money in it, because that's what we do for a living.
Thank you. Can I just ask the second question, which was looking outside London, and you hinted at it in the presentation, could you tell us a little bit more about, particularly in Oxford, where you've mentioned corridors where the road works have now gone and you've seen a bounce back. How strong that's been and whether that's recovered back to and above prior levels, and what kind of, if you like, performance on the volume you're now starting to see there as a harbinger of what might follow when the rest of the city's done?
It's a good question. We've only got one corridor to take, one corridor to take that experience from at the moment, which is the Abingdon corridor. And the problem with the Abingdon corridor, really into the minutiae, is there was nowhere else for anyone to go. That was the route that goes into Oxford. We lost about 9%, and that is consistent with what London Transport for London have also experienced in terms of some of the congestion problems they've had in London. And we haven't had all of that 9% back. We've had most of it back because, quite naturally, people may find other ways of travelling. But we've got the majority of that back. But what we've learnt from the lesson is you actually have to start the marketing of your service much earlier than what we actually did in terms of attracting people back. We have to work much harder to do it. You cannot assume that people will come back. That's the first lesson we've learnt. So when the next corridor finishes, can't remember exactly which one that is, we will be ready for actually marketing the service, saying it's, you know, putting our better buses on it, making sure we've got the ones with Wi-Fi, doing things that can attract it from a marketing point of view. Because quite naturally, people will drift away and people will come back in, and we've got to resell our product. So we've got to do more of it. But overall, we're confident enough that people do return.
Good morning, it's Annalise Vermeulen from Morgan Stanley. I have a couple of questions. Firstly, on the international markets, I think you're in the running for two in Germany. If you can give an update on the timing of when those might be announced, and when we'd hear further news on those. And similarly, how much of what's coming up next year and in the coming months are you looking at? And then in the same thread, aside from Germany and Singapore, are there any other international markets that you might be considering? And then part of the same question, given the volume of UK rail coming up, like you said, and also internationally, what are your sort of expectations for bid costs for 16 and 17, bearing all that in mind? And then lastly, just on the roadworks, following on from Damien's question, whether you have any indication of timing as to when, for instance, in Oxford, that might all get wrapped up. And I guess in London, it's much more longer term. But again, are any specific areas of London where we might start to see that bounce back in the coming year? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'll start with roadworks and then work backwards from that one. In terms of Oxford, it's a two-year programme. And when they finish that two-year programme, it's also linked into the development of a shopping centre in the centre of Oxford. And so we would expect all of those to be finished. Now, you're affected differently as it goes around the city. So, and it's very difficult to predict exactly what each set of roadworks will create, because traffic is like water. It will flow find its own way through. The Abingdon corridor, there was no other way through, so the people just had to sit it out. So the next junction, we didn't have so many changes on, and we'll see what comes around when they get round to North Oxford. It's an ongoing programme of works, and as I say, we've learnt some lessons from that, and we think we'll know better how to deal with it as the roadworks finish. But it is a two-year programme, and in the end, I went personally to see the equivalent of the county surveyor to say, hey, you know, come on, do it a different way, and said, we've got the money. This is about long-term improvements to the roadway in Oxford, and in the end, it will be better for everybody. And okay, we've got to get on with it. In terms of London, it's a similar sort of story. You can't get a growing city without growing pains. The public realm is linked into the cycle superhighways. We've been more affected by east-west. There's an east-west corridor, and there's a north-south. We've been more affected by east-west and north-south. That's just the way it turns out. I said quite clearly and deliberately that we've been disproportionately affected, and the reason for that is Elephant Castle is going through both cycle superhighways, regeneration, urban realm, and we operate the majority of services through the Elephant Castle. And that is going to happen for another year. So we've got another year of that to go through. But Lewisham, which is also about regeneration, that's now finished. We're also disproportionately affected by Lewisham because we run... I mean, I'd like them to move all this to sort of northwest London, where I don't operate many buses, and that would be really helpful. But actually, they're in the areas that we operate the majority of the buses. And We have 24% of the market, and we run a large amount of the buses in central London. We're disproportionate in central London, so we're affected by that. What's actually happened in real detail is that when the cycle superhighway started in about March, April of this year, no one really knew what the effect of it was going to be. So traffic is like water, it will flow different ways. But we ended up in a gridlock type situation because there's nowhere for that water to flow, for the traffic to flow. And so what Transport for London were doing was enacting some of the skills they'd learnt through the Olympics of gating traffic further out. Now that's fine, it keeps the flow working in central London, but we run buses in inner urban areas as well. So what it was doing was gating it out as far as Peckham and various other places where we also operate large numbers of buses. So it was affecting you out there. And also it was done on a trial and error basis. So eventually they found that they're still working through it and found a nice balanced equilibrium and that we finally got there. But March, April, it was pretty awful traffic conditions. I'm talking journeys taking 2 hours that would have previously taken 30 minutes. And of course that deters people. And of course it means we don't make our bonuses out of the quicks. It has to get better because all of this is a learning curve for everybody in terms of how to deal with the roadworks on an ongoing basis. But I don't really anticipate an end to them. I think what we had was a perfect storm of everything all happening at the same time and hitting central London, and it will get better. In terms of international markets, we have got two that we are due to put bids in for rather than two that we're waiting to hear of. So that will happen, and those bids are due to go in October. That's in Germany. In terms of next year, as I said, there are six franchises coming up. Two of them will be defensive ones for us, and we'll take views about what we bid for on the other contracts. Again, as I said to Damien, we take sensible views. We don't have a scattergun approach of bidding for everything. When we bid for something, we bid to win. That's what we do, and we will be putting all our efforts into making sure that we do sensible bids, but quality bids. And a global view, are we looking at markets outside of Germany and Singapore? Yes, we are. We've got a team of people who are looking at what global opportunities we can come up with. We've taken some views about places we will go and some views about places that we won't go. And there's always opportunities arising, and we say, do we add some value to this? Have we got some USP? Is it the right environment? Is it the right economy for us to be bidding in? And then we go from there. And we may or may not bid in another country. It all depends on those opportunities. And I think the last question would be bid costs for 16-17.
I mean, we kind of take an assumption that probably around £7 or 8 million a year on bid costs, which would probably cover two bids a year. So, for example, we've got London Overground coming out. We'll start the work on London Midland, then we'll move into South Eastern. This is over a two-year period. So, on average, two bids a year, around £7 to 8 million. And then I think you said what bids are coming up in Germany. There's a couple of bids going on over the next 6 months. So we should get to, and that's an ongoing basis. There's quite a few potential bids for us to work on because the pipeline is broader.
There's a broader pipeline. There's a continual process of new bids coming up. They don't cost a tremendous amount of money to bid for, but they're smaller volumes than the franchises in the UK. Okay, we've got Rani, you're nearest over there.
Thank you. Jolyon Wellington from JP Morgan. Two questions for me, please. Just on the decision... or the opinion that's going to be issued in October at the North East Quality Control Board. Can you just touch on what you think would be a positive and negative outcome in terms of what they might say and I guess what the sort of most likely responses would be? And then secondly, your net debt EBITDA is below your target. And I know you've talked about working capital reversals, but what are you planning to do about that? Are you going to say we'll run with a lower level of leverage, or are there ways of bringing that leverage back up?
Okay, I'll answer the first. Keith can answer the second. It's the Quality Contract Board. It's the first time it's ever sat as a board, and so it's all new territory from that point of view. They took a load of witnesses, a load of cross-examinations in a sort of in a court inquiry type process in July, and now they're going away and actually working out what their opinion should be. They have a set structure to work to, and they're answering the five questions about public tests. You know, does this meet the public test within the QC process? And it'd be very difficult for me to predict what they're going to come out with. Really would be difficult. As I said, and I would say this, wouldn't I? I think it exposed the fragility of what the offer was from Nexus. I think there weren't any great benefits for... I know there are no great benefits for customers. I still think a voluntary partnership is the way forward. But there is a very restricted range that the QC board need to respond to, and whether the QC being submitted by Nexus meets these five narrow tests. It really would be wrong of me to suggest what might be the outcome of all of that. I know what I think logically should be the outcome, but I couldn't predict what will actually they'll come up with. But I don't think it ends there, because I think actually what will happen is Nexus will then look for a devolution type process in terms of getting hold of buses in the northeast. So it'll be an ongoing process, I think. I don't think you'll get a position where there's a full stop and that's it, end of story. I think there'll be a continuing story.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, from a balance sheet perspective, you know, we're in a strong place. We've maintained our dividend policy, as is at the minute. Being below the target level, I think, gives us opportunities, as we've talked, to reinvest in things like freehold properties when they come along. It's not just about acquisitions. You know, our first thought would be to reinvest back in the business. I think that what we've said about balance sheet is we need to see how GTR plays out. We've said that right from the very beginning in terms of making sure that delivers the returns that we would hope it would expect. And also you throw in a little bit of the uncertainty around the legislation. I think we'd like to see how that plays through before we start thinking about whether our leverage is too low and start thinking about what we do about that. So we're by nature relatively conservative. But we have increased the dividend now twice, as soon as we've been able to, in line with our dividend policy. So we're very clear that returns to shareholders are important.
Hello, it's Joe Thomas from HSBC. Just back on GTR. I think you're sort of asking us to take a little bit on trust here. I mean, you're saying that Network Rail and the Department for Transport recognise that there is an issue, but it's not entirely clear when you're going to get compensated for that issue. Could you just provide a bit more visibility about what processes need to be gone through and the sort of timeline that we should expect before we see some compensation coming back to the group?
It's a fair question. The problem is that we haven't done this before, so we don't know what some of the processes we need to go through in terms of both with both Network Rail and DfT will actually be. What's happened? Let me give you the example we've given before, which is about London Bridge. It is a fact that we were planning to operate 24 trains an hour into London Bridge in the evening peak. It is a fact that we can only operate 20. Network Rail have written to us in a legalistic manner, which they have to do, to say that they haven't provided the infrastructure that we were bidding against and which we plan to operate. Those are facts. The fact of it is, it's cost us more money. But we have to work that through with Network Rail in terms of a load of other compensatory type issues along the way. And that, I mean, we started this it happened in January. We got a letter in about March. It's still an ongoing process. And along the way, we've picked up a few more contractual issues that we need to discuss as well. I won't even bore you with the detail of some of those, but actually, they're as equally complex and equally difficult to work through. So it's an unknown process, but if the facts are the facts, they have to be resolved. And they are. That's what, you can't ignore it. That is what's happened. They have to be resolved somehow, and we have to work that through with Network Rail, and we'll get to the end of that process. And similarly with the DfT on the timetable, they openly accept that we are operating a timetable that changed between what they put into the bid and what we ended up actually having to deliver in September last year, and that's cost us resources in terms of people and rolling stock. We've already, so there is a huge amount. So what we've been doing is actually in minutiae going through every single train journey and saying whether that train journey was in the spec or not in the spec, in or out, why it changed, what were the circumstances. And that's been a painstaking process with our chief train planner going through that. And now DfT are going through it and saying, yes, we agree with that, we don't agree with this, we agree with that, we don't agree with this. And you can see that when there's a huge amount of money involved and millions of train miles involved, you're going through the minutiae of it. And in the backdrop to that, of course, we had other issues taking place. So the election actually stalled some of that process. The spending review stalled some of that process. And we're just working through in a mature manner with DfT and with Network Rail and going at the pace that everyone feels comfortable with. I mean, you know, I want an answer tomorrow morning. I want it resolved tomorrow morning. I want to move on. But the truth is, we have to go at the pace that everyone feels comfortable with, and all the partners feel comfortable with. And as we go along, more things are changing as we go through these complex contract negotiations.
Can you give a sense of how you'd expect the compensation to come through? Would it be, would it be as with a sort of legal dispute, a cash lump sum? Would you expect to see something come through, in improved terms in the back end of the franchise? I don't really see exactly what you're
able some of it will be in changing benchmarks, for instance, changing performance benchmarks of what we're expected to achieve. That could be one of the outcomes. Some of it will be in recognition of rolling stock changes. Some of it will be in cash. Retrospective and going forward, some of it will say only up to this point, because from that point onwards the timetable on this particular area does match exactly what was in the bid. It really is, this is something that at the moment I'm trusting people within GTR to actually get a grip of all the detail and be on top of the task. But we actually have to explain that logically to either Network Rail or to the DfT as to why we think there's a difference. We have to go through a selling process as well.
Just turning to buses, I may have misheard you before. You were talking about BSOG. Did you say that you weren't expecting any change to BSOG?
I was saying that I've not heard anything that suggests there would be a change to BSOG. That doesn't mean to say there won't. I've just not heard anything. At the moment, there are no smoke signals that say BSOG is going to disappear. That's the best I can say.
I mean, if you remember last time, we were given a good, I think, 18 months notice of a reduction in BSOG. If they follow that process, then we haven't heard about the potential for something happening at some point in the future. But we haven't heard anything at all.
Trevor Koo from Liberum. A couple of final questions. What's happening on the wage front? Any sign of any pressures building? Maybe some colour by region? Are you perhaps getting any help in the northeast given the unemployment situation there? And also, could you just talk us through the impairment on Go East Anglia? What was the trigger for that? Is there something specific going on there? Was the performance particularly poor?
Okay. There will always be wage pressures. There will be wage pressures on... It doesn't matter what's happening in the economy. The nature of what we operate, there will always be wage pressures, and we manage accordingly, and I trust the local managing directors to manage that. You do get some very faint regional variations at times, but the honest answer, I've never seen a direct causal link between high unemployment in a region and lower expectations on wages. That's what we deal with. That's the business we're in. In terms of Go East Anglia, it's a very small part of the business. We are being affected by the public sector cuts. What happens, most of our operations outside of London are commercially run. So it's about 70% of all what we operate outside of London is commercially run. Generally speaking, we run in urban areas. Generally speaking, that means we can actually make those all operate on a commercial basis. East Anglia is more rural, semi-rural type areas. And therefore, some of the services relied on public sector funding when we bought those businesses a few years back. And public sector cuts have come in, and that has changed the dynamics. And sometimes what we do there's a litany of examples of where public sector cuts have come in other parts of our networks, and we found ways of dealing with that for the local authority. Quite genuinely said, well, you fund it between A and B, but actually if we go via C, we think we can actually make it commercial and you don't need to pay any, put any money into the network and we'll carry on running it. So all the time there's been discussions between local managing directors and the local authorities about how they can deal with public sector cuts and find a way through it. And that's we think, taking a very mature, responsible approach to running networks outside of London. In East Anglia, it just becomes more difficult. There isn't enough commercial nature of that business to be able to do that. So therefore, we've had, in parts of East Anglia, we've had loss-making businesses, and we've just dealt with it through the accounts and dealt with it that way. But it's a very small part. And what I should say, though, is there's been some upside. We've actually won the Park and Ride in Norwich, so that's good news. So we're focusing on areas where we won't need public sector funding in sort of rural bus routes. Thank you. Can you. Are you allowed two questions? No, hold on a minute. No, I'm going to somewhere else before.
Alex.
Sorry, just back on GTR, you've talked a bit about how the compensation might work and so on, but just can you give any kind of critical milestones that you're looking for that will help illustrate the or drive the improvement in operating performance? Is it, for instance, trainee drivers coming through that might allow you to bring down overtime for others or bring on new services? Is it something that Network Rail has to deliver? And how can you see that this is improving? If it is coming through, when will you know? If it's not, you know, what are the signals going to be? And then secondly, I've noticed in the last sort of 5 or 10 years, my forecasts for sort of long bond yields haven't proved that accurate. What's your estimate for what your IS19 adjustment might be in the next year or so?
Right, well, Keith can deal with the second question. All of the above is the answer to the first question, because, as I said, it takes us 12 months to train drivers. We took over the contract in September. There would have been some drivers in the training school at that point in time. Some of those have come out. But the big influx of resource that we put in between now and Christmas of last year will come to fruition between now and Christmas this year. So that's when it will start. Some of those dynamics will change, and that'll be good news for everybody. The real key critical dates are those that actually changed London Bridge, so it's 2018. Those are key critical dates. We've got some key critical dates in terms of introducing new rolling stock, so we do expect the new Class 700 to be going out at the beginning of next year on the Thames Link service. That improves our performance. That is better. That means we meet various benchmarks. We meet our committed obligations. So there's the overall picture, which means that by 2018, you should have all of this infrastructure work in place. There are milestones that we're meeting and we're on target for doing, which mean that we feel comfortable in terms of what we're doing on that contract. And then in the background to all of that, as I've gone through, there's this complex web of contractual changes that we're having to work through, and most probably will carry on working through until 2018. So you've got operational performance will get progressively better with more staff, more trains, more infrastructure. But the background to all of that will be the constant movement of the contracts and negotiations about it.
I'm just adding to that on GTR. The other thing you have to bear in mind is the management really, on an integrated basis, have only been in place for a few weeks. And that certainly hasn't helped, I think, in terms of managing GTR when we've been running two franchises as separate entities. So I think that will... I think we'll have a huge benefit now you've got one settled management team. The other thing on GTR is that, notwithstanding the contractual disputes, you've got a normal franchise to run, so you've got to control your costs. You know, you'll have made bid assumptions that might end up being around wages or energy or inflation that may or may not be different. So it's not looking just at those things in isolation. You've got to look at it's a business we're running on a day-to-day basis, and we believe we've got the right management to do that. As far as IS19 is concerned, I mean, there's an appendix, slide 31. I mean, from a bus perspective, it's around £3 to £4 million, and it should be relatively stable. As far as rail is concerned, a very broad rule of thumb, it's up to 1%, roughly, of margin is pension cost for IS19, slightly lower than that. So that will flex according to how many franchises we operate. So this year it went up from 12 to 16 because we took on GTR partway during the year. And we'd expect that to be maybe a slight bit higher next year because you've got the full year impact of GTR. But then if London Midland didn't get a franchise, it would come down. So up to 1% of operating margin as a rule of thumb, probably not a bad way of looking at it.
Okay, Damon.
Sorry, if I can just ask, I'm being a nuisance, three questions about things that haven't been covered. First of all, in terms of the noises you're getting from your non-regulated bus businesses, what are they planning to do on fares this year? Are you simply going to reflect CPI and the fact that fuel is falling and the issues with roadworks, will there be any attempt to raise fares? The second one, I'm sort of, you mentioned you seem to have faith that the central London traffic situation will get better, and yet the Olympics was a temporary removal of road space. This is a permanent removal of north-south and east-west road space from all other users but cyclists. And yet the population is growing. People seem to have shifted elsewhere. What gives you confidence that we just won't be stuck with this current situation? And then very finally, if you've got these issues, undoubtedly everybody else has as well, but they don't have the balance sheet you have, particularly outside London with just that 7%. Would you look again and see if there are any attractive acquisition or consolidation opportunities that come up in the same way as, you know, Stagecoach has bought into First Group's depot in Plymouth?
Okay, thank you. We try to keep our price increases as low as possible because we try to attract as many customers as possible, and we're always concerned about elasticities of demand. We link it, generally speaking, to the index, generally speaking. But what we try to make sure our companies do is they do it intelligently again. So we don't have the what happens on the railways is well advanced, every fare goes up in January type of approach. We would, you know, fares, we would do different things on different routes at different times. Some will go down, some will go up, some will stay the same. One of the issues, frankly, in East Anglia was actually the prices have stayed the same in some cases since 2012, and that's been one of the issues that we've been facing. So we trust our local managing directors to understand what the market will bear and what they should or shouldn't be doing, and whether and how that matches other types of operation. One of the issues that I suggest may be going on is that actually as fuel prices have gone down, you actually get a reversal effect of modal shift, and some people may go back to the car because of fuel price, and they look at the marginal cost of their travel. So those are some of the factors that are going around. So you don't want to put your prices up too high. You want to try and keep them as low as possible. But of course, at the same time, fuel cost is only about 9% of our actual business. Our big cost is wages, as has already been asked about, and wages cost is about 65% of our operation, 62 to 64%. And those costs are always above inflation. They always end up. So we have that difficult balancing act all the time in terms of trying to keep the fare rise as low as possible, but at the same time recognising large parts of our business are getting over and above inflation increases in them. And that's what we're trying to do. And we're no different, I'd imagine, than other people. In terms of central London traffic, I mean, it's a good question. Ultimately, equilibriums are always reached at some point or other. Ultimately, it is a permanent removal of road space, and it is the allocation of that road space to cyclists. That's a mayoral policy, and the mayor will live by that, or their successor will live by it. It will mean most probably that other traffic will find other ways of getting around London. The taxi drivers will do different things. The goods vans will find different ways of going around, and we'll have to find ways of prioritising buses. The truth is, about traffic flows. It's not about the road. It's about the junction. It's all about how you manage the junction. That's what creates the traffic delays. It's not the roads that go to it. It's the traffic junction itself. And you can do different things with traffic junctions. You can prioritise buses, for instance, over the other traffic. And I think what you've hit the nail on the head on is once this is all over, there'll be other issues that TfL will have to work through in terms of how they manage that road network and how they may actually have to look at displacing other vehicle types to give more priorities to buses. Because in the end, the buses are taking 90 people along those routes,
and it should be the of you know, looking at the not looking at the volume of vehicles, but looking at the volume of people. So I see those as big issues coming forward. Balance sheet, do you want to?
I mean, you're absolutely right. We have a stronger balance sheet, and that's one of the options that are open to us. I mean, I think we're not wedded to any particular bus system. We operate in a unregulated and a regulated environment, so we're according to how the things change over the next few years, we'll adapt to that. So if that means we get opportunities to invest in new areas that we don't currently operate in, either possibly by buying up companies or building depots and bidding for franchise bus services, then we have the ability and we have the cash to be able to invest in that infrastructure and to buy the buses. So I think flexibility to deal whatever the future throws at us, I think, is important. And that underpins our decision on things like dividend to be, you know, and capital and that sort of stuff, because it, you know, we're trying to balance all these things.
Thank you. Can I just come back just on the 100 million 12-month deferred bus target?
Yeah.
Within that, getting from this year to that 100, how much of that is based on price and how much is just assuming the volume comes back to where it was?
I think we can only expect to see sort of 1-2% price increases over the next 12 months, because that's kind of where inflation is, and to do anything over and above that would be uncompetitive. And I think we're in this worst of all worlds in some respects, where we're seeing low inflation at a time where our cost base isn't decreasing in line with that, partly because of our fuel hedges. And the opportunity maybe in the next 2 or 3 years is a time where inflation starts to ease a little bit. We have the ability to put up prices at the same time when one of our significant costs actually starts to decline. So that's where some of the headwinds, and you know, it's a tough 12 months we've got ahead of us, start to turn into tailwinds over the next couple of years. So the hope is we still end up being, you know, two to 3 years' time, we end up being in exactly the same position as we would have been if we'd have hit the very linear 100 million target that we set ourselves. I think it's you know, very difficult to absorb what could be, you know, several million pounds worth of quicks and reductions without sort of accepting that that's going to hit your target. You know, that's quite, and it's quite happened quite quickly as well. And so I think it's least understandable why we are where we are, but we still think there's positive things that are likely to happen over the next couple of years.
Final question.
It's Sam Bland here from Investec. Just a question on the two sort of freehold properties in London. I was just wondering whether you could say they are sort of coming from an existing competitor, or are they sort of sites that will be converted into bus depots from something else, and whether they're sort of in your central London area or a bit more over in the east, where I think you've got a couple of other depots there. And in general, you know, you look to have quite a lot more depots in central London than other operators. Have you seen any other sort of operators trying to enter in and get depots in that very central location, or is that sort of quite secure for you and it's now very difficult for anyone else to get depots in those central areas? Thanks.
Okay. Answer to the first question is that they are not from other operators. The second part of that is I'm not going to tell you, because it's commercially sensitive, and we haven't actually completed the deal. But actually, I feel there's little risk involved in buying freehold in London, because freehold property in London is very difficult to come by. We're very pleased that we've come by these two bits of property. They will be perfect depot additions, and that gives us extra capacity for bidding, so that's great. In terms of other people coming in, other operators do come in. Tower Transit is an example. They've come in into central London. As a generality, they take on the depots of the operator that they've bought out, basically. Central London sites are obviously very difficult to get from both a planning permission point of view and to actually find freehold sites in central London for bus depots. But that doesn't stop people competing. It just means they change their timetable in and where they do their duties from, and they just come from further out. There's ways of managing that. It's not, you're not totally reliant upon a central London depot to bid for central London work. That's fine. Competition will always be there. Great.
Thank you very much indeed for all your questions. Really good questions. Thank you very much, and see you again.